You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll talk to a high school athlete working to break down barriers for girls in sports. Now, how easy is it for you to unplug, to clear your mind? It comes to some of us naturally. Others have to work at it. For example, the energetic overachiever Chris Traeger from NBC's sitcom Parks and Recreation.
Ron, you radiated mindfulness. What were you thinking about?
I wasn't thinking at all.
Incredible. It takes a ton of work for me to get to that kind of a clear headspace, no matter how hard I try.
Don't try so hard.
Don't try so hard. Ron, I'm going to try your not trying method right here, right now.
Our next guest, together with colleagues, saw a need for students at Lawrence University to have an opportunity to develop their own mindfulness and disconnecting skills. Constance Kasser is Associate Professor of Religious Studies at Lawrence University, Chair of East Asian Studies there. She created a new course for this fall term. It's called Doing Nothing. Connie, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Can you talk a little bit about the need you were trying to address in creating this new course at Lawrence?
Yeah, this course actually came out of a handful of conversations that some of my colleagues and I have been having over the course of the last few years. I mean, this even predates the pandemic. But one of the things that we were noticing was that our students seemed to increasingly not just have more stress and struggle with more mental health issues, but we were starting to notice that even when they weren't in class, they had a really hard time just relaxing. And I've heard from students again and again that they have trouble feeling okay just letting themselves just kind of rest. And if they're not in class or working or doing homework or doing something that's going to go on their resume so that they can get a job after they graduate, they feel like they're wasting their time. So we really wanted to create something that would give students a little bit of permission to slow down and disconnect a bit.
Now, this could easily be a story about kids these days, but I'm a little older than your students. I feel this sometimes. You know, I'm waiting at the bus stop and I pull out my phone because I don't know how to do nothing. I was just hanging out with my parents, and they are often in the same boat. This is about all of us. Why do we feel like we have to be constantly doing something as opposed to nothing?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is a result of, at least in part, you know, our smartphones. We have these devices with us at all times that provide us with constant distraction, constant entertainment. And we've forgotten to a certain extent how to just stand in line and wait for the bus. And studies have shown that doing things like just allowing your mind to wander, being bored, or getting outside and taking a walk, being in nature, meditating, all these sorts of things. We've seen studies that have shown that taking time to do these sorts of things can actually make you more productive in the rest of your day and less stressed and better able to function. So what we're really trying to do in this course is teach students skills to improve the other aspects of their lives.
Okay, I want to learn these skills too. What are some of the things that you and your colleagues are doing to help students disconnect and get some of that nothing time in?
Yeah. So, I mean, what's great about this course is every week is taught by a different member of our faculty or staff at Lawrence. And so folks are coming in and teaching either things that their own research and expertise is grounded in, or just skills that they have learned. So we had the very first week of class, Amanda Draheim, who's my colleague in the psychology department, came in and gave a lecture about the importance of sleep hygiene and having a sleep schedule. And she talked with students about the correlations that have been found between getting 7 to 8 hours of sleep per night and having a higher GPA. And so then she worked with students on setting goals for when are you going to go to bed? When are you going to get up? How are you going to ensure as a busy college student that you're going to get enough sleep every night? We had Linda Morgan Clement, who's our Dean of Religious and Spiritual Life. She practices Tai Chi. She came into class one day and taught us Tai Chi for an hour. We've had instructors in the dance department do mindful movement exercises with us. A colleague in the Spanish department took us for a walk on her favorite walk through Appleton down the Fox River. So we've done all sorts of different things in the class.
I understand this is like a one credit class. Students aren't getting, 3-4 credits toward graduation from it. Did you see a hunger from students? Did you get a good response when people were signing up?
Yeah, I mean, the thing that's really kind of amazing about this class is at the beginning of the year, the registrar sent out a list of just the class tallies, you know, and how big each class was. And behind our course at Lawrence, first year studies, which the entire first year class has to take, the next biggest enrollment in the class was this doing nothing course, or in the university was this doing nothing course. So there's a real hunger there. We have more than 50 students enrolled, which at a small school like Lawrence is a pretty huge class.
And they're doing this, as I understand it, if I'm in this class, I leave my phone behind?
Yeah. So there's no homework, there's no final exam, but the requirements for the class are you show up, so you have to come to class, you participate to the best of your ability, and you don't use your phone. And that's actually been maybe one of the harder things for some of our students.
What's it, the class, I think, is just about wrapping up. What has been the response? What are you hearing from students involved?
The students who I've talked to have all had good things to say about the course. And they've told me that they've recommended it to their friends. We're going to offer it again in future terms at Lawrence. And, you know, one student said that, you know, when she leaves class and she goes and talks with her friends outside of class, she talks about what she learned in class. So I feel like that's a huge benefit, that the students who are in class are learning things and then they're going on and talking to their friends and their classmates about some of these skills that they're cultivating.
Now, this course has gotten attention, not just from WPR, but from local and even some national media as well. Were you surprised that this caught on?
Yeah, I was really surprised. I tweeted about it a couple of months ago and just, you know, said, I'm teaching this class. It's called Doing Nothing. And it's one of the highest enrolled classes at my university. And overnight, and the tweet wound up getting more than 130,000 likes or something like that. And then I was contacted by Time Magazine, and CNBC came and filmed our class. We even made it on Fox News. They had a kind of a different take on what we were doing in the class, but they didn't really take the time to understand what we were doing.
So if people are thinking, yeah, I do too much, I am too easily distracted, I don't just zone out, I don't like spend time in my own mind that often, could you leave us with some advice, some things we could try on our own time?
Yeah, I think, you know, this class that we're doing, we meet for 1 hour once a week. And for some students, that's actually proven to be too much. Some students have come to me and said, I have to drop the class because I'm too busy, which is kind of unfortunate. But I think, you know, even if you don't have an hour, even if you don't have, you know, 10 minutes in your day, I think one thing that can be really helpful is to, you know, the next time you are waiting for the bus or standing in line at the grocery store, don't pull out your phone right away. Just pause for a minute, take three breaths, just three breaths. Like, it doesn't have to be that long or that involved, but just take those three breaths and pay attention to your breathing. And I think that can drastically shift your frame of mind.
All right. Well, I have plans to be at a bus stop in a little while this evening. I'll give it a shot. Connie, thank you so much for sharing this with us today.
All right. Thank you.
That's Constance Kasser, Associate Professor of Religious Studies at Lawrence University. We talked to her about the new course she created at Lawrence with some of her colleagues. It's called Doing Nothing. Hey, are you good at doing nothing, or do you find yourself always reaching for your phone or for something? Let us know. Email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. Right now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with the answer to a Why Wisconsin question about effigy mounds.
At one point in time, thousands of effigy mounds could be found in what is now called Wisconsin. These ancient burial sites are still significant to members of the state's First Nations. We recently received a question through the Wisconsin Project from a listener who wanted to know more about the effigy mounds. Liz Domes went to learn more about the people who created them.
The path winding around Lake Wissota in Chippewa Falls is thick with bugs and sweltering heat. About half a mile into a hike along the lake trail is a simple wooden fence and a sign. Hidden here under thick foliage is a mound that's more than 250 feet long. It was raised with soil 1,000 years ago to form the shape of a panther. It's an effigy mound, one of thousands across the state. Peter Crisco of Waniwok is curious about the sculptors who created these ancient mounds. He's a sculptor too, and nature is his biggest inspiration.
I would like to learn everything that I can about them, and, you know, how it's connected to the human civilizations that lived here before, and how they connected to spiritual world, and how it all comes together. Because I think it's very relevant for our time, because we are so disconnected from nature.
Amy Roseborough knows all about the mounds in Wisconsin. She's an archaeologist with the Wisconsin Historical Society.
All right, so what is an effigy mound? An effigy mound is a burial mound made out of earth. It's a sculpture. It's a funerary monument.
That's Roseborough during a PBS Wisconsin University Place lecture in 2016.
Effigy mounds are unlike other mounds in that they're shaped like animals or spirits. It could be birds, could be bears, it could be even human form.
Their creations include the man mound in Baraboo, the double-tailed turtle in Madison, and the panther in Chippewa Falls.
And they're built by a group of people we call Late Woodland between AD 750 and 1200.
In a follow-up phone call with Roseborough, she says the Late Woodland people move dirt with wooden spades and digging sticks.
They are taking the dirt from a very shallow area. In other words, they're kind of scraping dirt so that the land will heal over very, very quickly. And they're not going to make a permanent alteration. They just want the mound to be there. That's it.
In her research, Roseborough found evidence of more than 3,100 effigy mounds in Wisconsin. It's estimated that there were many more than that, but there aren't records of them. Roseborough says about 90% of the effigy mounds once strewn across Wisconsin are now gone.
And once the area started to be settled and developed and colonized by Europeans, they plowed them under, they took them away for fill, they quarried, they built houses on top of them.
State law eventually protected these sites, first in the mid-1980s. Members of the Ho-Chunk Nation are fierce protectors of the mounds. They have long said that they're the descendants of the mound builders, and they've been very deliberate about what they share when it comes to these sacred sites.
The traditional court has told me upteen times that every time we expose this information, it gets sabotaged, ruined, or irreversibly damaged.
That's Samantha Skenendor. She's an attorney at Quarles and Brady and a member of the Ho-Chunk Nation. She spent almost two decades working with First Nations all over the country, helping to preserve cultural sites. She doesn't have authority to share the full story, but Skenendor did say that the mounds are a physical response to prayers of desperation sent by Ho-Chunk ancestors to their creator, Mauna.
They were lacking direction and foundation with themselves, their spirits. Wakan is their spirits, or Wakan was lacking and needed support.
They prayed to Mauna, who promised to put medicine in the ground.
The Creator built them for us and had them rise up and show us who we are, where we're from, and that those will always be there for us.
The spirit of the effigies will take care of us, but we have to take care of them too.
WPR's Liz Domes brought us that story on effigy mounds. She answered an audience question as part of the Wisconsin Project. Submit your question and we might answer it in a future Wisconsin Life segment. Go to WPR.org/Wisconsin. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Coming up, a female football player for Pewaukee High School's team talks with us about what it's like to play on a mostly male team and why she's working to empower other girls and women to play in more sports. That's next here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. At Pewaukee High School, every senior on the football team started at least one game this year, and that includes senior Ava Matz, who took snaps as quarterback in the homecoming game there. She completed a 10-yard touchdown pass and worked to break down barriers for girls and women in sports. Ava Matz played free safety and quarterback for the Pewaukee High School's football team, the Pirates. She also plays basketball and softball. A senior at Pewaukee High School, she joins us from there right now. Ava, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Before we get to football, obviously sports are huge for you. How did you get so into sports?
I mean, I think my parents always had me in a sport at one age or another. And, you know, I like the busy lifestyle, but I'm also very competitive. That comes with everything, board games, anything. I love to compete.
Now, football. We've seen girls play usually on special teams at the high school level. What made you want to pursue, you know, playing positions, quarterback and safety?
You know, quarterback, my parents always told me I kind of had an arm. And at recess, I'd always play with the boys. And I'd be like, yeah, like, this is something I wanted to do. And then freshman year, we kind of got to, like, pick our positions and stuff like that. And I was like, I'm going to rock it at quarterback. Like, I'm going to try it out and see how I do. And I stuck with it. Originally, I had started as an outside linebacker of my freshman year. That wasn't really the place for me. Sophomore year, I got moved to free safety, and I enjoyed it much more. It was just a better fit for me physically. And I helped lead the VR team my junior season and senior season. I was a leader to the young guys, kind of showing them the ropes and stuff like that, and making sure that there's people to fill the shoes when us seniors leave.
What kind of response did you get, especially from your teammates?
You know, at first, I think they were a little unsure, like, why is she here? What is she looking to do? And you know what? As now seniors, all the boys, I share a ton of love for them. They respect me. They treat me so kindly. They make sure, you know, like, I got taken down a couple times during the game. You know, they're right there to pick me back up, ask me if I'm doing okay. They're always there looking out for me, and I couldn't ask for another set of boys.
Now, you are in the books now. You have a touchdown completion to your name in that game. What was that moment like?
You know, it was a little scary. The play kind of, in reality, did fall apart, you know, but I put my trust in the boys, and, you know, I knew that Krzyzewski would take it all the way, and he, you know, it was second thought. He just did it, and he made it happen, so.
Now, yeah. This is part of a wider effort for you, not just for yourself, but for other girls maybe coming up into high school to try. Maybe it's not football, but to try sports and maybe ones that girls don't think about pursuing. What is your message to them if they're listening right now or their parents are listening right now?
I think my message is always, like, try hard. You know, if you have a big dream, you know, always follow it. My big dream was to play football, and, you know, I stuck with it and I followed it. And, you know, I couldn't be more happy with the decision I made. You know, you have dreams because it's something you want to pursue and it's something you're interested in. And, you know, you have to take risks and you're going to make mistakes. But in the end, that just makes you a better person, a better player, better athlete. And it's so amazing to see other girls out there. You know, when we were playing our homecoming game, there was actually another girl on the other team. And after the game, she came up and talked to me and was like, you're so inspiring. And I think, like, I'm not the only one that's doing it, but to see that we can inspire others to do it makes it all the more worth it.
Talking to Pewaukee High School senior Ava Matz, athlete in multiple sports, basketball, softball, and on the football team. Ava, as I mentioned, you are a senior now. Do you have a vision for what you want to do athletically after you graduate?
Yeah, my plans are to get accepted into UW-Madison and row on the Badgers rowing team for the women's team.
Have you done crew? Have you done rowing before?
I have never done it before, so it's going to be a completely new experience. But, you know, I think being well-rounded in athletics, each sport's different. You know, football, basketball, softball, each of them are a little bit different. And I think it'll help out and be in my favor.
Now, what's three sports? You never really have a rest period, right? Could you talk about your workload being in three sports, all of which have fairly intensive training regimens?
Yeah, it's crazy. I mean, football starts right away in the summer. So, you know, like, once school ends, we get a week off. And then we have, like, the off-season conditioning, strength training, everything like that. And typically, well, like, last year since we went to state, you know, I missed the first 2 weeks of basketball season. This week, we unfortunately lost in level two. So I had a week off, took that time to rest, heal up, and now we're into basketball season. We're on week two. And then right after that, it's softball. It's never ending. It's so busy. But I feel like I thrive with a busy schedule. I love to be around my teammates. They make me a better person, better student.
Can you talk about that that social connection value that you get out of sports? That's something that I think people don't always think of as we're just watching the game on the field.
Yeah, I mean, having teammates, you know, like, there's solo sports out there, but most of my success comes from my teammates, you know, like, pushing me at practice, pushing me in the weight room, you know, pushing me to be a good student too, you know, like, they hold me accountable. And I think that's helped me be so successful in sports and in school, is they hold me accountable and I hold them accountable. And, you know, from there, you only take steps off each other, you grow, and you just make this friendship and pretty much a family. You become a family with your teammates because you care for their successes, they care for yours. And it's really important to have teammates that support you and that are looking to help you.
And I should ask, I know you played quarterback and free safety on the football team. What are your positions in basketball and softball?
Basketball, the past couple years, I've kind of been playing a post role, but this year, we're like everybody's kind of like wings, guards, stuff like that. And in softball, I play first base.
All right, Ava, thanks so much for joining us. Good luck with the next steps in your athletic career.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
Been talking to Ava Matz, a senior at Pewaukee High School who played this season on her school's football team. She opened as the quarterback for Pewaukee's homecoming game this season, has a touchdown completion to her name. Ava joined us to talk about playing as a woman on an all-male team and why she wants to help encourage other women to check out a wider variety of sports. Hey, if you have a story about your athletic career, on a boys team or a girls team or a co-ed team, love to hear about it. Been thinking about doing an open call-in on athletics. It's been quite a while. Let us know. Email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. Also tomorrow, we'll talk with the author of a new book on friendships among sports fans. Turns out that sports fans, in some cases, have more friends than non-fans. So we'll look at the social connection that comes out of athletics. You can share your story with us right now. Head over to the Ideas Network Facebook page or email ideas@WPR.org. Sport fans, I love them. Do you too? Again, email ideas@WPR.org. Also coming up tomorrow on Central Time, we'll break down the midterm elections, what happened that we expected to happen in Wisconsin, what may have moved away from expectations. We've got Craig Gilbert, longtime reporter at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, to bring us the demographics, what happened by region, what swayed the election one way or another. Plus, stop and listen to the birds and watch them and take your time about it. We'll talk to the author of a new book that makes the case for slow birding. That's all coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, many voters said abortion was one of the top issues that drove them to the polls. We'll take a closer look at the role that reproductive rights played in the midterm elections. First, the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources released a draft of a new proposed wolf management plan last week. The agency said some of the main goals of the plan are to ensure a sustainable wolf population and reduce wolf-related conflicts. The DNR is seeking public feedback and input on the draft plan for the next 60 days, and we want to hear your thoughts. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you taken a look at the new proposed wolf management plan? What's your reaction? What questions do you have about the way the state manages gray wolves? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Adrian Wideven is a retired forest wildlife biologist, chair of the Timberwolf Alliance Advisory Council, and assistant co-chair of the wildlife group for Wisconsin's Green Fire. He served on the Wolf Plan Advisory Committee and helped develop previous DNR wolf plans. Adrian, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
Can you, before we get to this new plan, can you give us the state of wolf management right now? What is the current guideline, the current plan we're operating under in Wisconsin?
So the current plan we're operating on was a plan that was produced in 1999. There were some minor updates done to that plan in 2007, and there were several attempts running from 2009 through just recently of trying to update that plan, but those efforts didn't lead to an actual new plan until the last 2 years of efforts, and now we are seeing a new plan being proposed.
Now, something that strikes me as different in this draft, I went looking for the number, and it seems like a lot of past plans or proposals have said, you know, here's our target number for the right-ish amount of gray wolves in the state. It seems like this new plan is taking a different approach. Can you talk about that?
Sure. The plan is getting away from numeric goals, and the department is doing more of that with other wildlife as well. Currently, deer management, bear management is less based on an exact numeric goal, but try to decide with the current populations on the landscape whether they need to be stabilized, whether they need to be reduced, or whether they can be allowed to increase. And the department has taken a similar approach now to wolves here as well. And in the zones where they're most suitable, in zones 1, 2, and 5, the department is going to be taking a very careful approach in allowing the population to remain at relatively stable high levels, but perhaps apply more controls in areas where there's more likely to be conflict. So it seems like a good combination.
Can you talk about the balancing act, I guess, regardless of zone, but mainly in the main wolf areas in the state between, as you said, a sustainable on the large side population and a conflict with humans in various ways?
Sure. In areas where there's good areas of wild lands, extensive public lands, wolves perform useful ecological benefits, and having a healthy, stable wolf population on landscape is very useful for those areas. In areas where you've got more highly modified landscape, where there's more more cattle, more livestock, more people living, more pets, there's probably more of a risk of having a conflict. In those areas, we probably want to maintain a lower wolf population. So this plan seems to strike a good balance between allowing healthy populations to maintain on the landscape in the areas of suitable habitat, but keeping the population under more control in areas where there's more mixed habitat or less suitable habitat.
We both use the phrase balancing act here. There are going to be people... Let's start with people concerned that, hey, this plan could mean there are going to be more wolves than I want in my area. I'm worried if I'm a farmer in this area, I'm worried about livestock depredation. What would you say to reassure them that that can be managed at the sort of numbers that targets that the DNR is aiming for here?
Well, I think especially like in some of those kind of situations, it's often localized controls are going to have more of an impact than what the wolf population looks like in a large zone or across the state. So in the case of a farmer having wolf problems, the plan does allow a variety of not lethal and non-lethal techniques once they're off the endangered species list for managing problem wolves within those areas. And there are some areas of concentrated wolf depredations, wolf conflicts that are being designated for maintaining lower wolf populations in those areas. So the department's had now many years of kind of following the wolf population. We kind of know the places where they're going to have problems, and those are some of the areas that have been identified to maintain lower wolf populations. But that represents a relatively small percentage of the overall wolf range in Wisconsin. So suggesting that across much of wolf range, their populations can probably be allowed to stabilize or maintain at near current levels. But there are some areas where we may want to have some reductions.
We're talking about gray wolves with Adrian Wideven, longtime wildlife biologist here in the state, now with the Timberwolf Alliance Advisory Council and Wisconsin's Green Fire, looking at a draft plan from the state DNR when it comes to wolf management, gray wolf management in Wisconsin. Goodbye target number on this plan. Hello to different zones around the state, balancing the needs of a sustainable wolf population with possible conflicts with humans. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you want to see in your part of the state? Do you like the idea of trying to have larger populations where appropriate? Do you have concerns about that? Do you have questions about how all this works? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Adrian, let's take a step back now and look at the long-term trajectory of gray wolves in the state. We had 50, 60 years ago? They started moving back in gradually. Give us a little overview of the history.
Sure. So the population was mostly decimated by the end of the 1950s and were considered to be about zero by 1960, and slowly started coming back in the mid-1970s with the state and the Federal Endangered Species Act that provided protection of the Minnesota wolf population, and they started gradually spreading into the state. The Wisconsin DNR started a formal wolf monitoring program in the fall of 1979, and every year since that time have been counting wolves in the state, and that population went from the first year being counted as 25. The most recent estimate was about 972 wolves. So we've seen that population really grow over time from a population just barely making it and now a fairly healthy population that's having ecological impacts on the landscape.
One of the big questions people may be wondering about is, what about hunting wolves? And we've seen via the courts this back and forth, hunts are on, hunts are off. Where do we stand now? How difficult does that make all this for the DNR to plan if they don't know whether a hunting season is going to be allowed, required, or forbidden?
Well, the way hunting would occur in Wisconsin, wolves would have to be off the federal list of endangered species, and currently they are, again, on the federal list of endangered species. The state of Wisconsin, the legislature, has set regulations that when wolves are not on the federal or state endangered threatened species list, the Wisconsin DNR shall hold a wolf hunting season. And that's what this plan is partially about, is kind of prescribing how those wolf hunting and trapping seasons will be done when wolves are not on the federal list of endangered species. And we expect that with the healthy wolf population in Wisconsin and adjacent areas in Michigan and Minnesota, that they will again be removed from the federal endangered species list and management will again return to the state. So we expect there will be some sort of a hunting season. But this plan does explain how that hunting will be done, the kind of goals the department is planning for the various zones, where the department is going to have very limited impacts on the population, other areas where they might have more controls on the population. And one of the things the department includes in here is having buffer zones around the Indian reservations that provide better protection for those packs living on reservation lands.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. John is with us in Shawnee County. John, hi.
Yeah, how are you doing?
Good. What did you bring up, John?
Well, you guys put these out there, and people have dogs running around. I had two dogs killed. Two of my black labs killed, a female and a male, killed by wolves on the land where they put out their wolves. They just put them out there. So you're telling me this is what happens? I'm walking down the trail, doing something in the woods, and I'm not being attacked.
John, thanks for the call. Sorry for the loss of your dogs. John, this is a concern, Adrian, that people have about their pets, their dogs and cats in particular.
Yeah, sorry to hear from John as well. And those kind of things do occasionally occur. Of course, wolves are not put on the landscape. Mm-hmm. They've got here on their own. But I can understand when a person's angry and frustrated that often you're going to look at for somebody to take the blame for that loss. But that's a situation that occasionally occurs, and the department is working hard to kind of reduce those conflicts and identify those conflicts. If they're off the endangered species list, those wolves would be removed. Currently, the department only has authority to use lethal controls if there's any kind of a human safety situation. And sometimes when dogs are attacked, there may also be perceived a human safety situation where lethal controls would be authorized. But, there are efforts underway to try to reduce those kind of risk, and those are the kind of things the department wants to educate people about.
Thanks for that call. We're talking to longtime forest wildlife biologist, chair of the Timberwolf Alliance Advisory Council, Adrian Wideven, about the latest proposed wolf management plan from the Wisconsin DNR, currently in a comment period. You can comment to us at 800-642-1234. Have you dealt with and or seen gray wolves around Wisconsin? What has been your experience? What would you like to see from the DNR when it comes to managing the wolf population in our state? What questions do you have about the biology, ecology, and management of gray wolves in Wisconsin? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue this conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Barrett. We pick up our talk now with Adrian Wideven, retired forest wildlife biologist, chair of the Timberwolf Alliance Advisory Council, with us today for a look at the Wisconsin DNR's new proposed wolf management plan. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. How do you think Wisconsin should manage its gray wolf population? What do you think of this proposed plan from the DNR? If it's allowed again in Wisconsin, should wolf hunting be allowed, required? What should the limits be on that? Share your stories, your questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. Adrian, we've talked in the past about the role that the gray wolf plays in Wisconsin's ecosystems. Can you give us a little overview of that and how it fits into this new proposal?
Sure, and that's one of the things the department really recognizes is having a healthy, sustainable population that provides ecological benefits. And we know that within forested areas, wolves can have an effect on the deer herd, less of a suppressing effect, but moving the deer herd around more, reducing over-browsing, over-grazing that we see in the middle of wolf pack territories, a greater diversity of wildflowers, less heavy browsing on trees and shrubs, smaller trees and shrubs. We see that there's a greater diversity of greater abundance, perhaps a red fox, because the gray fox or coyotes are being suppressed. That in turn allows for the red fox having more of an impact on small mammals, which are also major seed predators that affect the trees that are growing. So there's a lot of connections in the ecosystem by the having that healthy predator, apex predator on the landscape. There's probably a reduction in the spread of chronic wasting disease and other diseases that spread through the deer herd by having a healthy wolf population.
You mentioned coyotes. Keith from Dane County couldn't stay on the line but was curious about the interaction between wolves and coyotes. He says he's more concerned about the threat of coyotes, wondering how their paths interact.
Wolves can have kind of a suppressing effect on coyote populations. They don't eliminate coyotes because there still are healthy coyote populations close to wolf pack areas. But what we do find is the interior wolf pack areas, there's less abundance, less presence of coyotes, and that in turn then allows red fox to do better in those places because they get suppressed by the coyotes. And red fox are major predators on small mammals, which can include mammals that spread Lyme disease or affect the seedlings that will eventually become trees in a forest. So the wolves are probably having some impact on our coyote population. But coyotes are doing very well across all of Wisconsin currently.
Go back to our callers now. Sylvia is with us in Oshkosh. Sylvia, hi.
Hi. I'm just calling about that. I have 40 acres and cabins west of here near Black River Falls. I live in Oshkosh, and I've been at my cabin for too many years, probably 60 years. And in all those years, I've never been injured by a wolf. I've seen them in the woods. They've never come after me. I've had bear, and I guess I heard someplace that in the state of Wisconsin, nobody's ever been killed by a black bear or a wolf. So I don't know if that's true or not, but I'm more afraid of a stray dog because when I went to school, I used to get chased every morning by dogs. So I'm not afraid of wolves. A stray dog is too friendly. You know what I mean? They'll come up to you. And I know I've never seen any aggressive wolves on my property. I've seen them as I go back to the river when I walk, but I've only seen two come near my cabin, and one was so skinny, he looked like he was starving to death. So I don't think they get too many stray deer.
Gotcha. Sylvia, thanks for the call. Sylvia sees deer on her land, not too worried about them, it sounds like, Adrian.
Yeah, it doesn't sound like she's too concerned about wolves. And for most people, they don't need to be that concerned. And one of the things that the department did with this plan was also do a major public attitude survey. And in that attitude survey found that majority of Wisconsinites support having wolves at current or larger population levels and at current distributions across the state. So similar to Sylvia's comments that people can live with wolves. They are not a threat to human safety. There have been very rare cases of wolves attacking on people, but as Sylvia points out, the neighbor's dog is probably much more of a risk than wolves or bears would be.
Thanks for the call, Sylvia, at 800-642-1234. Russ joins us now in Verona. Russ, hi.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. I guess I'd like to suggest that maybe we could take a more enlightened approach like they do in Europe. So instead of paying off farmers for lost livestock, they get these farmers trained herd dogs, and they protect the herd animals, the cows, the sheep, or whatever, from the wolves.
Russ, thanks for the call. Adrian, apart from just compensating for lost livestock, whether it's training the dogs or other methods, are there ways to reduce those conflicts so we don't have to pay that compensation in the first place?
Well, sure, and I think it's good having both a compensation payment program, but at the same time providing mitigations to reduce losses. And the department, through USDA Wildlife Services, does provide a lot of abatement practices. There's the USDA Wildlife Services folks spend a lot of time putting fencing around farms, putting up a flattery, a special flagging device, providing guard dogs, guard animals is frequently used, especially for sheep. guard dogs are very effective with sheep. They're probably less effective with cattle, but various types of fencing are very useful. Flattery, some changes in animal husbandry, being able to clean up some of the carcasses of dead animals can be useful. So there are non-lethal methods that help reduce wolf depredation and reduce the need to have to pay farmers.
Thanks for that call. Talking to wildlife biologist Adrian Wideven about a new DNR proposal for gray wolf management in Wisconsin. Back to your calls. Saul is with us in Stevens Point. Saul, hi.
Yeah, hi. Just wondered if there's any transmission of CWD to wolves and or coyotes.
Oh, interesting question. Chronic wasting disease, very common in deer in Wisconsin. I was wondering about that myself. Do wolves get it?
No, there has been no evidence that chronic wasting disease spreads to any of the predators that feed or scavenge on deer. So wolves have not been involved too much in chronic wasting disease because it's pretty much out of the areas where wolves are living. But coyotes have been detected to feed on infected animals and do not catch the disease. Mountain lions have fed on infected animals, and there's no evidence of them catching the disease. So it doesn't spread into the predator population.
Thanks, Saul, for the question. Will joins us now in Eau Claire. Will, hi.
Hi, guys. Quick question. In managing wolves and determining policy, in your experience and that of other biologists and program developers, have you had any misconceptions and myths, if you will, in forming your policies, you know, that you've had to deal with, that people have had with them? So,
Adrian, myths and misconceptions you've run into about the wolves.
Well, I think there's a lot of myths that we hear of, myths such as the idea wolves are brought into Wisconsin, that wolves are going to have devastating impacts on livestock industry, that they're a threat to human safety. Those are some of the myths that we especially have to deal with. But there's also, the person talks about misconceptions and learning, and one of the things that DNR emphasizes is this is an adaptive approach to wolf management, and we learn over time that things change. When I started working with wolves in the 1990s, we thought Wisconsin could hold about 150 wolves. By the late 90s, we were guessing maybe about 500 wolves. And the current estimates are the state could probably have a healthy wolf population around 1,240 wolves. So we learn more about the wolf population as we study them. And so, yeah, there are myths both on the sides of people who have misconceptions about what wolves do and biologists as they learn more about the wolf population.
Thanks for that question. In our last minute or so, Adrian, this is a proposal. A lot of work, a lot of time went into it. That's not the end of the story, right? These are not guaranteed to become policy.
That's right. I encourage people to read the Wolf Plan and contact the DNR, submit your perspectives, your ideas on how the Wolf Plan can be improved, and support those parts of the plan that you think are good. And there are a lot of good things in this plan, so I'm hoping that a lot of people do contact the DNR and let them know that there's a lot of things in this plan they would like to see formalized. So, yes, encourage folks to check into the plan and send your comments to the DNR.
Adrian, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
Adrian Wideven is a retired forest wildlife biologist, chair of the Timberwolf Alliance Advisory Council, and assistant co-chair with the Wildlife Group for Wisconsin's Green Fire. He's with us today for a close look at a new proposed gray wolf management plan. This came from the Wisconsin DNR, and as Adrian was just saying, the DNR is now in the midst of a comment period. You can give the plan a look and give the DNR your feedback. You can also check out more on that report from our news team at WPR.org. Coming up today after the news, we'll look at the role abortion played in the midterm elections and where the issue could go from here. Could look very different from state to state. And as always, you can join in with your thoughts. What do you want to see happen in Wisconsin when it comes to abortion law? You can email right now, ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org, and share your thoughts. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time. You're listening to the Ideas Network.